Welcome to the MedTech Talk Podcast. This is your host, Jeff Pardo. And this month, it is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Rodney Perkins to the podcast. In addition to being a highly accomplished physician throughout his life, Rodney is one of the most prolific and successful inventors and entrepreneurs in our MedTech ecosystem. From Collagen Corp to ReSound to Procept and Pulmonix, Rodney's inventions have helped shape and advance an amazing number of medical specialties. Rodney, it's wonderful to have you on the podcast.
Good to be here, Jeff.
Well, great. Well, yeah, this is truly a pleasure. And, you know, in every conversation we've had over the years, I've learned so much. And that was really, you know, the thinking and getting you on the podcast here is and I know you've done many of these, but at least to give some of the listeners to this podcast the benefit of a lot of your insights that you've gained from all your different ventures and experiences. And one thing I thought it'd be fun to kind of start with is really your early interests. And I know as a child, you loved to work with your hands. And I'd love if you could just describe kind of how your early childhood kind of sparked your interest in science and medicine.
Well, as I look back, this is a retrospective. You have to see how it did, because at the time I didn't know it was doing it. It's like being in a storm and you're not sure why it's raining. But I, as a child and a young boy, I always loved to climb trees, looking for forks for slingshots and making them. And I always had a knife with me, and I would carve a lot of things, whittling and everything. And then later on, I would carve race cars. And in World War II, I would carve solid airplanes out of balsa blocks. And so I got onto that pretty early, this thing, and I think it had something to do with it. But probably the interesting turning point of this was even kind of at the start of that. I don't know, I was 7 years old or eight or something like that, maybe. And I read a lot of comic books. And at the end of a comic book, I saw, and these had a Charles Atlas ad at the end. And Charles Atlas was a kind of a bodybuilder that somebody starts to beat up on me, up on him at the beach. He goes and works out, and he comes back and he cleans up those guys that were calling him a, you know, skinny kid. And also there were ads, and there were ads for an alligator. Now, I was in Evansville, Indiana at the time, and an alligator was a pretty exotic creature to a 7 or 8 year old, and you could buy them. And so I saved my pennies, and I didn't know how much they were, 10 cents or 15 or whatever they were. So I sent off to this foreign place, Florida, for my alligator, and I waited and I checked the mail, etc. Didn't come. Finally, the box comes. I open it up, and here's this alligator. And I kind of pushed it, and nothing happened. And I kind of put some water on it, and that's when nothing happened. And finally, my mother came in. She says, Roddy, she called me, the alligator's dead. And so I thought, oh, they're never going to believe me that my alligator arrived dead, and they'll never send me another one. So I wrote them this extensive letter about how it arrived dead, and would you send me another? And they said yes. And so I did the same thing, wait for it, open the box, and that one was dead. Oh, okay. I thought, they'll never believe me now. So I really crafted another letter. And finally, they sent one, and I opened the box, and the alligator was alive. And so my mother got a wash tub, and you put a brick in it, and you have water in it, but you have to have a place for an alligator to get out and dry. And I'd feed it bird seed and everything, and I was tending to my alligator, and this, everything was going great. And then one day I walked in, and the alligator's dead. And I just concluded from that, that the place, Indiana, wasn't a place for alligators. And so mother said, why don't you take it out in the backyard and bury it? So I went out in the backyard and I dug a little hole, and I was about to put it in the hole, and I had my knife with me. And I thought, I wonder what the alligator's like inside. And so I slid it actually up the abdomen and into the thoracic cavity of it, and I opened it up, and I could see the intestine and the heart and lungs, and I was just fascinated by that was in my little alligator. So I put it in the dirt and buried it nicely. Probably put a rock on it that I liked or something. And I think there was kind of I didn't have any idea at the time, but it was a combination then of this mystery of the human body and using a knife, which I used all the time, in my whittling and everything, was I think the combination of that was maybe the moment that subconsciously I put together these two interests. And then it developed further later. But that was the initial thing.
That's an amazing
And
story. And I can only say that you must have had really understanding parents to laugh for 3 hours. Your
Yeah, well,
neighbors were probably the happiest people that the alligators didn't survive.
another story that is along that line. Later, we lived in a very poor, not a very poor, but a poor area town, and my dad, if I'd gone to school there, I'd kind of gone to the kind of the tough downtown school in Evansville, Indiana, in high school. And so my mother had died when I was nine, and so he moved from that area and bought an inexpensive house in a very good college prep public high school district. And it was there then, that kind of the second influence came in, I think, on this. There was a doctor two doors away, a GP, and I would mow the lawn in the summer for this little office. And I got to know the doctor a little. And my dad would sit out on the front porch. This was on a regular medium-sized thoroughfare street in Evansville. And people on his evening hours would drive up and they would park all around when his little parking lot got full. And they'd frequently park in front, but we could see who went in his office. My dad would sit out there in his rocking chair, and we might be out there. And he said, you know how many people went and saw the doc, Wilhelmus, what's the name, Doc Wilhelmus? And I said, no. He said, he saw 35 people last night, and he said, how much? I said, how much does he charge for, or my dad did, how much does he charge for this? I think it's $5 or $7 or something like that at the time. My dad adds it up. He says, that's pretty good. And I thought, that's interesting,
That's right. It's
but
impressive.
and I got to know him, and he invited me later when I was in pre-med, and I was around one summer, and he invited me to go to the hospital where he was assisting on an appendectomy. And I went in and, marveled at the operating room, and I'm standing there and I watched the general surgeon and him do an appendix. I think it was an appendectomy. And I said, God, this is neat too. And I started looking around at all the instruments and everything. And of course, that fed into it. But the idea of combining these things was, I think, what got me interested in being a physician. And it also encouraged, I think, the entrepreneurial aspect, because in that, when I went into surgery, I did. My first devices were just to create a new instrument so I could do an operation better or a new operation that I thought could be done. So I just started with little hand instruments. Then it was a kit. Then you needed a company to create it, like LaserScope. We need the laser, of a certain type. So all of these things pulled it together.
I
And I
think
think it's this combination, but the carving, the knives, the early exposure to an anatomy that was, exotic to me, all contributed to that.
I think it's so interesting because, it's, I think we live in an age where, when people grow up, there's sort of, a kind of a master plan that either they have or their parent, more likely probably their parents have for them. And they go to school, graduate school, they get a job in the, but your experience, from a young age, to me at least, be interested in whether you think I'm getting this right, but you're really gathering information, gathering things from your environment, and sort of one thing leads to another. It's not like this master plan that you had, but you saw a doctor and you saw people going to their house, and I imagine you thought, well, there's a livelihood you can make in being that. And I wonder if you could touch on that, because you also use a wonderful analogy in some of the talks that I've listened to of this idea between spoon carriers and fork carriers. And it strikes me that that process of information gathering has gone on for a long time in your life.
Yes, there's a concept there that I think is very important to the differentiation between an inventor and an inventor is not it is not he, the an inventor is an entrepreneur in some ways, but that is not the whole story on the whole entrepreneurship. There's a difference in it, but the idea of where and how does an inventor get their idea? We read comic books and stuff like that, and it's oh, Eureka! Suddenly, here's the whole idea. It really doesn't really occur that way. It can, and sometimes you put it together just very quickly. But I think it's a good analogy to think of the world around you every day, everywhere you are. There's information, and the information is floating around. Analogize it to I call it info rain. It's information is in the mist all the time, and a drizzle. Sometimes it's storming and it's a lot of information. Other times it's just high humidity almost. But the information is all around. And I think of it as there are two kinds of people in the world out in that rain. One of them is a fork carrier and another is a spoon carrier. And the spoon carrier and the fork carrier out in the rain, and think of the rain as being a bit of information, or think of it as a letter, for instance, A, B, C. So that rain is coming down, and those two people are out there with their kitchen utensils. And the fork carrier, this rain that hits the hand, but it just dribbles through the fingers of the tines of the fork. And this goes on through, and nothing happens. The spoon carrier is out there with the spoon, and one letter hits it, stays in the spoon, second, third, fourth, fifth, and pretty soon a word starts to form or an idea starts to form between the relationship of those letters. And so finally, that letter spells discovery or new idea or whatever it is. And those people are, I think what it is you have to have your mind on receive all the time. You never know where it's going to be. There are higher target zones for medical device innovation, and that's one obviously is the operating room is a target-rich zone. Other target-rich zones are at the bedside. In the operating room, you see something that some nurse is complaining about and complaining it's inefficient, or a doctor is griping about the instrument isn't right for some reason. All of these things are information, and it gives you ideas. And so the other places that I think are very good for that, for surgical devices particularly, are hardware stores, and you see all sorts of little chisels and knives and screwdrivers and other things. I still, every time I go to my local hardware store, I still almost take an extra aisle just so I could look at what's there now. And you put all these things together, and they give you ideas. And I think a terrific example of that is Alexander Fleming, the famous British bacteriologist. When they were all working on petri dishes and spreading out bacteria and growing them and studying them, everything, you know, the story is well known that they were complaining about some of their experiments getting messed up because something was getting in the petri dish and knocking off their growth of these bacteria. And of course, Alexander Fleming says, "Why is this happening?" And he discovers that there's a mold getting in there, and he discovers it's the penicillium mold. And that he says, well, maybe there's something there. So long story short, he extracts gets the active ingredient out of the whole study, and he calls it penicillin. And a whole new era was born out of that. Mm. And so why didn't the other bacteriologists still figure that out? Well, I think it's very interesting that I would call Fleming a spoon carrier.
Yeah.
His mind was on receive. Your radar is on receive. And I think that's a principle. And you never know where it's coming from. And frequently it'll come from some other area other than your primary area of interest. In the companies I've had, if I have a medical advisory board meeting, one thing I always put on there was, you know, technology watch. What have you heard about when you got the MAB together, you know? What have you heard about something else that's kind of interesting? Because invention is a combination of things that hadn't been put together in that combination before. For instance, if you take the Gutenberg press, that was an invention that changed the world. But there was nothing new about the Gutenberg press. I think movable typeface was known in China for a long, maybe a couple hundred years or something. Paper or something to write on was known. Ink was known. Yet here, even the wine press was known. But never had anybody taken all those things and put them together into an integrated thing with another purpose.
Yeah.
And so he did. And Gutenberg changed the world with that one thing. But there was nothing new. It was a combination of all previously known ideas that had been around for some time.
Yeah.
And I think you do this, you listen to people. I just love to watch things and then something will come to mind. But it's those combinations that make the difference. But you have your mind again, your radar's on receive.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, these are such interesting concepts. And I think, yeah, you look at medicine as, you know, the specialties. I think often you can think of plumbing and, you know, carpentry, as you said, and things like that, and applying things in our, you know, in our natural environment and to the human body. And I think even now we're seeing in medicine, you know, you have a certain concept in one part of the, you know, the body, and you're able to apply it in a completely different specialty in a different way. And so I think, yeah, I think you're right. I think that is a really interesting process. I wonder, you know, if we could go now trace back to your, because I think what's been really important for you has been your career in medicine and being able to have a front row seat to, you know, practicing as a clinician, and then also, as you said, gathering this information. But maybe we start in sort of otology and what interested you in sort of hearing care. Why did you get into it?
Well, that was a fortuitous thing almost, and it was again not the path I was taking at that time. I had as a junior undergraduate, I had taken the medical school physiology course. I'll start there. And then instead of going into medical school after 3 years, which I could have. I decided I'd take an extra year because I was a little younger, extra year as an undergraduate. One, I was going to be president of the fraternity. I had kind of been a gunner, and I hadn't taken some courses I wanted to take, you know, that I thought would be good to take and interesting. So I stayed around that extra year, and at that time I got a job at the as a TA at the Medical School Physiology Lab, which was on the Bloomington campus of Indiana University. And later they combined that first year that was down there in Bloomington with the last 3 years at the medical school in Indianapolis. And so by that time, I had really decided I was going into cardiovascular surgery because my special interest as a physiology TA was in cardiac physiology. Mm. Of course, at the time, that amounted in a lab to, you know, having a frog opened and dropping some adrenaline on their heart and watching a stylus on what was called a chymogram. It was, you had a loop of paper and you'd smoke it so it had carbon on it. And then the writing arm, when you had something attached to the heart, it would pull on a little lever and then give you a mark. And you shellac that, and you that was your way of doing it.
Wow.
It sounds very crude, but that was the way it was at the time. And so I was very interested. And then I went to Indianapolis, and I got a job as a student assistant in the Advanced Cardiovascular Surgery Research Lab. And my job was taking care of the dogs and debarking them and getting them ready for surgery and that sort of thing. And part of the job then, we were going to do mitral valve replacements. And I would get the dog prep, put them on the table, and then I would assist the resident or the fellow that was in the lab on doing the mitral valve stuff. And it was a messy process. I mean, the hair was all over the place. It was wet and it was cold, and you had to dry off the dog and everything. And so I saw one day, I looked over at, and I see the disc oxygenator there. And the way the blood was oxygenated in the early days there was you had to think of a glass cylinder with two metal ends on it and a rod going through it that turned. And on that central rod that was turning were discs, and the blood would run through the horizontal cylinder and run through, and the discs were turning, and the film of blood would come up on the disc and it would be oxygenated by the time it got out the other side. And I thought, that looks like a refrigeration fan. A lot of surface area and changing what's on the surface all the time. And so I had I went out to some machine shops around Indianapolis. I got some people to kind of do some stuff for nothing because I didn't have much money, and had some discs made and a axle made that you could put fluid in and out. And so then I did dog experiments with that because I knew how to hook up the dog. I knew how to, you know, get in the artery and get in the vein and, you know, anything you had to do. And I would did the experiment, and I could cool or warm the dog to any temperature I wanted in 4 minutes. And I could take it up, I could take it down. And so I entered that into the AMA contest that year for the research prize, and it won first place.
Wow.
And so, you know, I had no idea of a product. I didn't patent it. I wrote a little paper on it. But that got me so interested in cardiovascular surgery. But it did pave my way into going into, you know, the good options for residencies because of that winning the first prize. And as a, and during the last part of that senior year, when I was all ready to go in that, I had a perforation in my eardrum as a child. And I got that fixed. And so I had it fixed, and it didn't work out so well. And I thought, well, that shouldn't be that hard to do. And that is another piece of information. The other corollary of that is when I won that prize, I went, part of the prize was to take my exhibit to the AMA convention, which was held at the Fontainebleau Hotel, which had just opened in Florida. And it was a really, you know, fabulous hotel for the time. And you had a free room and board during that. And so I went and I had my exhibit. And the guy that won the resident division, intern and resident division, there was a medical student division and an intern resident division, was a plastic surgeon from Memphis. And he, our booths were right together. And one, you know, like a Wednesday afternoon and kind of slow in the booths and everything, he said, hey, you ought to see this thing that somebody from my hometown's doing. This guy is taking out the stapes with a microscope for a condition called otosclerosis, where the third little ear bone is fixed and doesn't move. And hence a hearing impairment. So I went over and I saw John Shea's experiment there. Not experiment, but what he was doing. And that was really interesting. And so I thought I'll follow up on that. And that is really in a microscope in surgery. What could you do with that now? And so I, two times during, after that, during my senior year, I drove from Indianapolis to Memphis overnight, and I'd watch him do surgery and then go back. And he would do maybe 7 or 8 cases a day. And I did that twice, and I thought, this is really interesting. Think of what all you could do with the microscope. And there, it wasn't being used in other fields, really. And so I thought, this could be very exciting. And all the kind of reconstruction you could do in the ear, also in neurosurgery and other places. And so I was, it was a great struggle for me to have the pathway all set in cardiovascular surgery and the doors open to go to the best residencies. And I said, I just think this other is so interesting, I'm going to do it. And so I switched over to be an ear surgeon, because I thought that's fascinating. In this small space, you have so many things you can do with the ossicles, with cholesteatomas, with perforation of eardrums, with congenital anomalies, et cetera. And so I went off and got into that. And that that turned out to be very good. The other would have been excellent also.
Yeah.
But that was another turning point. And that's one of the things that I think is important. Lessons learned, and maybe we'll get into some of that later, and it is, you know, what lessons do you learn? Well, that a good example of that lesson was, I think if you use some Yogi Berra sayings, sometimes you can find some interesting things. And one of them was, if you come to a fork in the road, take it. And if you, that doesn't mean you, every time you have a struggle, you give up something. But sometimes you're going along and it's fine, but then something else comes along. Don't jump at every shiny thing, but don't deny sometimes that this is information, new information. And if you're a spoon carrier, you'll pick it up a little more.
So yeah, yeah,
that's another career thing made a difference on that.
Yeah. And certainly you entered an incredibly interesting field, right? And one in which you've had a tremendous impact. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about ReSound. And also have a question just in maybe now as we sit, you know, here in 2024, the general state of sort of hearing and improvements to hearing, because I think let's start with ReSound, but I'd love to get your view on kind of where we stand today in terms of technology development for hearing and where we can go from here. But maybe start with ReSound to set the table.
ReSound was a very interesting company. It was my third company. First was Collagen Corporation. All of them based on trying to do something. Collagen Corporation was ended up being the first injectable collagen, but it didn't start that way. It started with trying to create a biosynthetic eardrum for eardrum perforation repair. And I won't go into the details of that too much, but it ended up being Collagen Corporation. We had an eardrum that we could make, and you could use it as a graft. But when some people put some money into it, and we started looking at all the things, we found out that there were certainly a lot more wrinkles in the world than there were perforated eardrums. And that's how collagen got started. But ReSound was interesting also in its genesis. I was working on an implantable hearing device that you would put in during surgery. And so I was working on that in the kind of off to the side in a few other rooms in the building that my office was in. And I needed an acoustic engineer, but there weren't a lot around in the valley. You could get a lot of computer engineers, but there really wasn't a lot of high numbers of acoustic engineers. And so I went out on a trip for a week around the country and up in Canada to look for some people that had been recommended maybe to check out. And when I did, I found out that at Bell Labs, they were working on a hearing aid secretly, and had about 18 engineers working on it. And one of the engineers that I'd been given their name was in that project and the head of that project, actually, to see him. And that day, the chairman of AT&T had said, "We're going to get rid of all this other stuff we're doing." And they were into X-ray and sound and everything. "We're going to get back to our core of communications and everything. And we're getting out of all this other stuff that we're in." And so, to make a long story short, I finally worked out an arrangement with getting that project and put that in instead of that other project that was going along. But I saw that this done properly could be a big change in hearing, and it was. It was the first hearing device that had put advanced signal processing into what was kind of a suede shoe industry with, three little screwdrivers that you could adjust the volume and the sound a little. And that was a big game changer at the time. And but that again is, if you come to a fork in the road, take it. And I think that was a good lesson. And I think there in this and all these companies, the business part of it I knew nothing about, but being on the boards of these companies, I learned that, relatively quickly. Although it has never been my kind of core focus. I love the early part of a new venture of up until, 30, 50 people. And after that, it takes on a whole personality. And I think you need different skill sets at different phases in company development.
Yes, for sure. And that would be an interesting topic too. But before we do that, I'm curious to get your thought on, because I think we probably every one of us has a parent or relative or someone that's suffering from hearing loss. And as you've talked to me about it, I mean, hearing loss is not simply the loss of hearing. It's also all the things that come along with it, the isolation, the, risk of dementia, all the things that can be really devastating for someone who's in the process of losing their hearing. And I'm curious, how close we are, do you think, to someone really improving their their hearing not to the point where they can hear in crowded places, where they, can really sort of almost mimic their natural hearing. Is that, will we achieve that level of hearing restoration, do you think?
Well, I think that certainly the present hearing aid industry is in a great state of flux right now. The OTC rulings and everything, it's going to be a really changing game. And I think technologically, it is a changing game too. The improvement of the sound quality and the ability to hear speech and speech improve speech understanding and background noise is the holy grail of the hearing device industry or the hearing improvement industry. And that can be done. And I think when you do that, you move the person from this isolation bubble that they get into, and it allows them to continue their interactions with people, with activities, and for them to appreciate sound in the environment. And I think that's a big step forward to avoid a lot of the depression that comes from isolation, the anxiety that people have, and I think that withdrawal affects their rate of cognitive decline because you're not using all the pathways that you once were, and you lose interest in things. And I'm a strong believer you can do all the and go to the gym as much as you want, do all the exercises, keep yourself in good shape. But if you do not keep your mind active and all your systems active, you will have a much more rapid decline in health and I think in cognition. So this is something that I view as a very important thing and continue to work on it.
Yeah. You mentioned something, related to sort of the business of these startups and kind of different skill sets for different stages of a company, and also just, recognizing or being self-aware of maybe your own limitations. I wonder how hard is that as an entrepreneur to be able to, start something, be really the engine behind an idea, and then know when it's time to bring on other people, to let other people take, in essence, control of what you're doing. How hard has that been for you in your various ventures?
Well, it's in some ventures it hasn't been difficult to do because I've felt confident in the people that there's with. And also I think one needs to know what do you do best? What do I do best? And there's a frequent thing in VCs always say, well, they don't like tech founders and because they aren't suitable for the commercial stage or we need to get somebody else. I don't think that's true. I think a tech founder can be a terrific CEO. They're analytical usually. They just have to understand what they know and what they don't know. Let's say the commercial part they don't know as well. Well, admit you don't know that and find somebody smarter than you are that loves doing that. And if you have somebody who loves what they're doing and they're, have met the standards or whatever it is, whether it's marketing and sales or whether it's electrical engineering, we all have to reach a certain bar of the understanding of the technical or the practice expertise of what we're doing. But the thing I've always thought that signifies who is going to be the best is, and I use this in when I've interviewed people for executive positions. Once they have that and they have others, all the skill set, number one thing you want in a person is passion. Passion for what they do, and they love to do it, and the skill set to do it. And it's very, very hard to beat a person like that if they're a competitor. The large companies, and I think we in the United States are very fortunate to have these wonderful global reach companies, J&J and Medtronic and Pfizer and Abbott and et cetera, et cetera. And this gives us strength. But that's a different corporate skill set than the entrepreneurial part. I always love having the big companies as my primary competitor because they cannot move fast enough. They're kind of like the infantry. And in the early stage companies, you have to be like the cavalry. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to move and change your tactics quickly, change the horse direction quickly. And that is something that generally larger companies can't do well. They have the inertia of a very big ship. You can't turn that on a dime. And yet, I think the combination of a vibrant entrepreneurial set of companies combined with the completely different skill set of the larger companies is what gives us tremendous strengths economically, health-wise, in this country. And there's nothing like healthcare to really make you feel good about what you do. You're changing the lives of hundreds of thousands or millions of people. It takes a lot of cooks in the kitchen to do it, but it's very worthwhile. And I've always kind of judged, you know, how good is something of how many thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of lives you're going to affect. Then patient, how you view it as patients you'll never see.
I couldn't agree more. I always thought, at least in my side of the table, you know, venture capitalists should have, you know, two scorecards. One, of course, is sort of how well their deals do from a financial point of view. But I think equally important is how well they do in terms of how many patients they actually help. And
there's probably a parallelism.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, right, exactly.
There's probably a parallelism there.
Yeah.
You know, I think if you take a hedge fund operator, their scorecard is how much money you make.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that, by the way, in my mind,
mm-hmm.
because that's the objective of what they're doing.
Yeah.
And one of the very interesting things, a lot of people have made a lot of money by financial manipulation and skill set. There's nothing wrong with that. The measure of it, though, is what do you do with it when you make it? What contributes back to society? Somebody, let's say like Bill Gates or others that have great philanthropy that reaches worldwide. You take if the object is a skill set is to make money, let's take a hedge fund operator and make a lot of money. And that's the goal for them to do, and their skill set is to do that. That's great. There, the other part of that coin is what do you do with all that money to help humanity? And to apply that to different things is where that skill set helps millions of people.
Exactly.
If you've done it that way. In medicine, you're closer to your primary objective is to improve healthcare. And I think in improving healthcare, I always judge it very much of how many lives have you influenced? How many lives have you improved the quality? How much longevity? And these are all leverages that you get from being entrepreneurial in the healthcare business. I remember when first starting in this, the first thing I did in it, I was very criticized for being, you know, that there was a company involved. It's okay to do research. This is way back, right, in the 70s. It's okay to do research and publish and that sort of thing. But my God, to create a company, and you mean there's a product and there's profit with that?
Yeah.
My heavens, it was looked upon as, if it wasn't unethical, it was certainly crass.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of criticism for doing that. Now you have, you know, five people a week calling you wanting to know how to do it.
Yeah.
Right? But it takes, again, I think, a team of people, just as there's a team of entrepreneurial companies and a team, other part of the team is are the global big companies. To have a successful entrepreneurial effort, you need not only the medical entrepreneur and the technical people, but you need the right capital and the right capital base that understands what they're doing and that is a big value. I think if you keep the patient in mind in everything you do, your studies, your design of the product, the safety of the product, and you're a long way to being very successful in it. If it's, good, it's got to be a good idea and people have to need it and want it. But it takes good venture capitalists, it takes good lawyers, it takes good clinical research people, production people. It's a team that you build. And once that's clicking, it gives dividends to the public.
Couldn't agree more. And I think something you said earlier about the passion of the entrepreneur, of the founder, and how important that is, that really resonates, because there's no one that's going to work harder than that person to make that idea a reality. At the same time, we do, there's probably very few founders that actually are able to go through that whole life cycle. And I wonder what is it? Is it that process of being very self-aware that you think separates out those founders that are able to adjust to different stages and bring in the people that they need versus those that can't do that? Or what separates those that can grow with the company versus those that really need someone else to come in and take it to the next level?
Well, I think thinking about that has something to do with the skill set and of the individual entrepreneur and their honesty with themselves. You can have a tremendous technical person starting a company that after a while doesn't work. Your skill set is different if you're a group of five scientists working on something than it is when you're trying to manage a company of even 50 or 100 people. But if you move it into the thousands, then it's a bit of a different skill set. And you, it, not that a technical founder can't do that, they can, but do they want to? Is their skill set oriented? Do they like doing that? If they like doing that, why didn't they get into that in the beginning? But you can learn these things and move with it and still run the company very successfully. I mean, you look at the tech in the valley, the electronic revolution. So many of those leaders were all skilled scientists, electronics. I can name them, within 3 miles or right here. And they were very interesting people, but they were able to emerge from the technical solution into other things. Many of them, though, when they got to a certain phase that you don't hear their names now as the CEO, realized that they didn't have that skill or they didn't want to do it, or somebody else could do it better, or they may have thought they could do it, but many other people didn't. Some are good at it, some aren't, but there are exceptional numbers of people who have made that transition from being a technically skilled person into one who has the ability to organize people, to energize and to lead them.
So interesting. Something else, we've talked about and I've heard you talk about as well is the importance of self-care for an entrepreneur And I wonder if you could talk about that as sort of the survival kit that you've sort of thought about and developed. Could you elaborate on the importance of that for an entrepreneur?
Yes, well, that's something that came about over the years of doing this, and I give a presentation on entrepreneurism and many of the things we're talking about. Questions would come up: how do you do this, and how do you maintain this? And so I did put together. I have sort of a module that I can use. I call it the Entrepreneur Survival Kit. How do you do this repeatedly, or even one or two times? How do you do this and not wreck your health? How do you do this and not be divorced three times, have your kids on drugs, have suicides in your family? Because the passion of an entrepreneur, you get that idea, you don't want to go to bed. You want to keep working. Mm. You don't want to do this. You want to keep working on what you're doing. And that can be very detrimental to your own health and to the health of people around you, because your passion is so much that you don't see the rest of it. And I think from that standpoint, the things that I put forth in this survival kit, that I would say, quote, survival kit, is one is maintain the machine. You are a machine. You're a bio machine. But if you don't oil it and you don't keep it working and keep it healthy, you're not as good a machine. And so in that regard, I emphasize a number of things. One is diet. Try to eat healthily. I think I went to internship and surgery residency on Snicker bars, and that isn't a good idea for a longevity. So eat well. Also exercise the machine. If you don't use it, you lose it. Mm-hmm. And you're exercising your mind a lot, but you aren't exercising your physical exercise. Mm-hmm. And we're one body. There are neurohumors, there's a brain, there's muscles, there's ligaments, there's a tartar. All of them have to be working in unison to be an effective person. So exercise. The other is sleep.
Yeah,
I think it's Jason Bourne of the Bourne Identity, and that was a movie, wasn't it? As I recall, he was a kind of a seal-like person in the jungles of Indonesia or mm-hmm. Thailand or somewhere, and they were taught that you may be in a firefight for 72 hours sometimes. So every time you have a moment to rest. Rest, important thing. If you rest, I take a nap, brief one, every afternoon. It energizes you well into the evening. And you can do that. I've been fortunate. I've had a couch in my office for a long time, so I'll just lay down. Always have an alarm or something set, because if you don't, you can't go to sleep very well because you're worried about sleeping too long. And then even if you have a cubicle, get a yoga mat, mm-hmm. roll it out under your cubicle and say to the people on each side of you, don't bother me. I'll be back in 30 minutes or 20 minutes. Roll it out, have a rest, and come back, and that is important. And the line that I liked on that Jason Bourne thing, the sentence was, rest is a weapon.
Yeah.
And it is a weapon.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's part of your armamentary to be, I think, a more successful entrepreneur and a more successful person.
Yeah, 100% agree. And another thing I think you've talked about is just the importance of taking time to think every day. And I think it's amazing with how busy everybody is, and particularly entrepreneurs. But when you don't have time to just step back and think. And for me, it was, I used to ride my bike to work every morning. That actually was a way to just clear my head and think. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how you've done that and the importance of it.
Yes, well, I think you're right there. And one thing that getting older, which I've had the fortune of experience of being able to do, thanks to modern healthcare and everything, is something I wish I'd have done long ago. And that is to think more and to not always have your mind just on the idea that of the day that you're trying to achieve. And one thing I found, and I do now, even though I could sleep in the morning, I don't. I get up very early before anybody else in the house is up, before the dog's up, and I go down and I make a cup of organic tea. You could have a cup of coffee or whatever. I have some nuts that I have out, and maybe a date, and a fig, and a banana. And I first, this is going to sound crazy to you, but I first have a mug of ice water because I want to get rid of the dehydration of the night. And I just have that ice water plus. The coldness stimulates, is a stimulus. And if you think of it, way back, what did Homo sapiens do probably first in the morning? They were a little dry at night, and they probably camped by a river, and they went and had a drink. So is there something in the process of more hydration when you get up rather than at night? And when you get older, you don't want to have too much to drink at night. And so do that, and then taste the different nuts. You got the almonds and the cashews, hazelnuts, walnuts, and you just put a few of them out and taste them. And when you taste them, really taste them. Hear the crunchiness. Now you're stimulating more and more, and you can smell the metal and the banana. Throw that in after a while, and so now you got the banana, and you got the date, and you got the different nuts, and then the mint tea, and all of those give you a different sensation, and you're stimulating that part of your body, and then while you're doing that. You can also, after that, I don't think about anything during that I've got to do during the day, during this. It's all just trying to think about what you're sort of feeling with that. And you're trying to follow your taste. And then if you do that also with some sound, music, and that sort of thing, you're stimulating that. And so I find that doing that for, 20 or 30 minutes, and then I go exercise and do, quite a bit of, probably 40 to 60 minutes of exercise. And then I come back and then I would sit down and say, okay, it's showtime. What do I have to do today? And then that's kind of a sample of what I mean by that.
Well,
And
yeah.
and as you get older, you think, gosh, how great it is to be able to do this,
Yeah, exactly. That sounds like a recipe for a lot of good thinking and a healthy life as well. And maybe it's a good segue to the last thing I wanted to just talk about was really your latest idea really around the contemplarian, and it's a good segue from thinking about things to, contemplating new ideas. And I wonder if you could, just as we close out here, to talk a little bit about the idea behind the contemplarium.
Yes, I have not even talked too much about this idea, certainly from a public standpoint. But as I've gotten older, I've thought, what really is the exciting part of things? And that I found is the thinking about how you might solve something and then thinking and then solving it. Also, I realized that there's a process going on in an entrepreneur's mind or self that sort of analyzes the probability of something, the risk of it, the positives, the negatives, where the roadblocks are going to be. And we tend to get started on something and then we say, oh, this is going to be a great idea and we're going to create a company about this. So they get in, they do it, they get a little seed money and go ahead and make a rough prototype or figure this out or whatever they're going to do. They do sort of a market analysis and that sort of thing. And then jump in and they get some money and then they get a little A round money and then there's a little more money in and now you got some more people involved because the money's in it. And then you, let's say you say, this isn't such a great idea after all, we've had a few failures here. Many times they just keep going.
Yeah.
Because there's now an entity, there's the jobs, the expectation, the investor wants not lose their money, so they're willing maybe to put in some more money. But maybe a lot of those should fold if they're too risky. And I'm not one to give up. I mean, one of my mantras is another Yogi Berra saying, it's never over till it's over.
Mm-hmm.
You do not want to give up if you really think that you have something, even though other people tend not to. You want to listen to them, but don't give up if you convince yourself you're right, on the right track. I mean, you, and others. You know. Mm-hmm. So I think from that standpoint, I thought, what can I do that I can keep doing this, but not to the scale or the intensity that I did before? And how can I, in some way, make it fun and also mentor others in how kind of you do this in some way. So I thought I would start something that I call the contemplarium. And it is the idea, it's sort of a think tank. It's not just a typical think tank. It's not an incubator. It's not an accelerator, which we know there are a lot of those around. But it's the process that the entrepreneur goes partially conscious and partially subconscious through to as the probability of an idea working.
Mm.
We make sort of institutionalize that early period, and the idea is that the contemplarium will be a place, it is a place, where you can have an idea. And is subject and a disease process that is significant enough that it needs improvement or a solution. And try ideas mentally and for a period of time that is sufficient to either accept the idea that it's highly probable or to stop it and forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way it works is that on a subject, and let's say the subject is sleep, or the subject is this tumor, or that tumor, or this thing, that you'd have a team of 3 to 5 people. Why 3 people? 2 people can kind of, it's small, and they can kind of convince each other that they're both right. And a third throws another observer in, and it also creates the feeling of a team, and you've got a little more firepower that it aren't taking forever to look into something. And why the top at 5, 3 to 5 on each team? Because after 5, you got a cocktail party, and you start to have too many, and you can't move fast enough then, because speed is an important thing. So the 3 to 5 people then are in a project group with a stated thing that is the objective, and you start looking into it. You talk to people about it, you read the literature, you look at all the IP around and that sort of thing, relevant to it. And you these teams are not full-time teams. They can have another job. They can be working at any company as long as it isn't in competition with the idea. You meet X number of hours, probably a week, that might be from 10 to 2 or something like that, or noon to 5 or something on a day. And you have a facility that accentuates the ability to communicate in small groups in different zones. And one is a creation station group and workstations, basically, where everybody has a computer and a monitor and all five. And you can come and work and do work that you would do there. And, you interact a little bit that way. And so that's one physical setting. The second is what we're in right now. This is our extension to the outside world, actually. Mm-hmm. And this is a Zoom conference room designed specifically for this space. The table that you're seeing is designed specifically for five people in Zooming. Mm-hmm. And so we can reach out if we want to talk to somebody at Cambridge in England and have them come in and we can talk. This is our outreach to the world. And also, we can sit here, and you'll notice that in what you're watching right now, in this, there are five chairs around here. Yeah. And so this maximizes Zoom for five people. And also, there's a whiteboard, three of them around in this area. And then the other area is kind of for two people. It's a little sort of coffee bar and just two seats and a whiteboard. Let's say another member of the team, you say, "Hey, Jeff, 2 weeks ago you mentioned this. I'm not sure I understood exactly what you're saying. Let's get a cup of coffee. Tell me more about it." Mm-hmm. So two people sit down. That's a different conversation than five people. And so you have that. And then fortunately around here, we can, we have a pool and tennis and stuff. And you can do that if you want to go do that and lunch. Yeah. And you can have lunch. Lunch is here. So it's a place that you then research this idea. And after a period of time, I imagine sometimes it's going to be 2 months. You say, "No, this isn't going to work. It's no go for this reason or that. Competition's too much. IT's too much. Or we forgot about this. That kills the idea." You stop it. "Thank you very much," everybody says. "It's been good." And you stop. But if you, on the other hand, you say, "Hey, this looks good. And this can really do a lot of good. And it's exciting." Then you can decide whether to develop a new code. Yeah. And you develop a new company. And the people on the team, not necessarily in that company, but are candidates to be. Because some of them may not want to. They don't want to do that. They like the interaction of their skill set and their expertise. But if you do, that spins and goes out, and it's on its own then. Yeah. And it, there's no, we're not going to have the companies here, right, or anything. If there is a new co out of it, we form it and get it going, and then Nuco takes it.
Well,
that's the idea.
Yeah, that's going to be fascinating to see what emerges. So I really look forward to that. And Rodney, go ahead.
And I think that in the process too, there's the for younger people, and on each team, I'm going to try to have a different span of age groups too, because I think that the skill set of the individual somewhat related to their age. Mm. If you grew up at a certain time, this technology was hot, right?
Yeah.
And now it isn't, maybe. It's two generations of technology later. But the experience of that person in something similar is very good.
Yeah.
If I were starting an AI company now, I wouldn't have myself on the team, from the perspective of a real contributor technically. But on the other hand, if you know, if it's something that was more in tune with where my expertise was or somebody else's expertise at the time, that's okay. And I think you get the experience plus you get the energy. And that dynamism is a mentoring function too. So you are passing on, or the team is passing it on, who by virtue of a little different perspective and experience, and I think that could be healthy too. So I don't know. This is something that we're just underway.
Well, it's going to be very exciting. And Rodney, I just want to thank you for taking the time today. It's as always, I've learned so much just from talking with you, and I think everybody's going to really enjoy some of the insights you've shared. So thank you, Rodney.
Well, it's pleased to be here, and thank you for all you do and your expansiveness and kind of knitting together the European or European colleagues and the U.S. colleagues with activities.
Oh, great. Thanks.